Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Okay, so this morning we were looking at the progress of meditation, how it is actually experienced by a meditator, and that is especially when the meditation is going really well, when it actually starts working by itself. So that was the how it is experienced psychologically, and now we're going to look more at the objective side, how the object of meditation is used, basically to acquire the same kind of psychological sequence by using the object in the right way here. So this is the next part. So this is now all about meditation practice that we are talking about here. And as I said this morning, one of the reasons why you know that this is about meditation practice is the statement here that the Buddha says, you resort to a secluded resting place. You go apart, and that is usually the a clue to say this is about meditation practice. So the next passage then, we are now in Majjhima Nikaya 27, paragraph 18, page 7, is that right? Still? Page 7, yes. So this is where we are. So I will read out this paragraph first, and then I will discuss it afterwards. On returning from his arms round, after his meal, he sits down, folding his legs crosswise, setting his body erect, and establishing mindfulness before him. Abandoning covetousness for the world, he abides with a mind free from covetousness. He purifies his mind from covetousness. Abandoning ill will and hatred, he abides with a mind free from ill will, compassionate for the welfare of all living beings. He purifies his mind from ill... where was I now? He purifies his mind from ill will and hatred. Abandoning sloth and torpor, he abides free from sloth and torpor, recipient of light, mindful and fully aware. He purifies his mind from sloth and torpor. Abandoning restlessness and remorse, he abides unagitated, with a mind inwardly peaceful, he purifies his mind from restlessness and remorse. Abandoning doubt, he abides having gone beyond doubt, unperplexed about wholesome states, he purifies his mind from doubt. So that is the next section here, and I'm sure most of you will recognize that this is about the five hindrances that you see here. So we are abandoning the five hindrances. And perhaps you wonder, we have been doing all this purification. How come that we are now abandoning the five hindrances? Having done all this stuff to get rid of unwholesome states, now we have to abandon the five hindrances. You would think that we had done that pretty much already, right? The point is, and this is the point here, is that we're coming to a point where there's only very refined defilements left in the mind, a very kind of remnants left. And this passage on the abandoning the five hindrances may give the impression that you are abandoning kind of coarse states of mind. But the reality is that here it's only the very last remainder of defilements that are being abandoned at this particular in this particular instance. And the reason you know that is because it comes after a long series of purification. And the next stage is the samadhi, the jhana states. So this is the last purification here. So here is this passage. It tells you that we need to abandon these things. So how? It doesn't say much about how to abandon. It just says you abandon them, right? So how do we do that? And of course, part of the how-to of the abandoning of the defilements is the process that we have been through. We've been looking at how to look at the defilements in a skillful way, of remembering the danger, remembering how to change your perception to actually abandon these things. So that is part of that, and that can also be used at this point. So if you are able to use that, if you're able to recognize the defilements, and you're able to abandon that way, great. But often what is required here, because sometimes you don't even know that there is a defilement in the mind. So often at this point we actually need a kind of meditation technique to abandon the last problems that are there. And this is where Satipatthana comes in to the gradual path. People often say, I read the gradual training, and where is Satipatthana? It's not in there. And it's true, you read it, and there's actually no sutta which clearly is the gradual training that includes Satipatthana in the ordinary way that you can see, you know, recognize it quite clearly. And it looks like it isn't there. But as a matter of fact, this is the place where Satipatthana comes in. And you see that very clearly when you read about Satipatthana in the suttas more broadly. You see that Satipatthana is always the thing that leads to the final abandoning of the hindrances and then unifies the mind and takes the mind into samadhi. That is the purpose of Satipatthana in the suttas. And that is why it is the seventh factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, stage by stage taking you in that direction. And this is clear from many places in the suttas. It specifically says that you practice the four contemplations of Satipatthana, and it says that through that contemplation, the hindrances disappear, and the mind is unified, and you go into jhana after that. So it's very clear that this is the main purpose of Satipatthana in the suttas. So this is where it comes in, and this is what is happening in this paragraph here. It is basically Satipatthana practice. And let us have a look at this paragraph in a bit more detail. So first of all, you see here on returning from the alms round, right? It could be argued it should be the other way around. After his meal, on returning from alms round, he sits down. So in other words, the Satipatthana, the practice of meditation, happens after you return. It's not something you do all the time. You do it at the right time. And you sit down, right? So meditation practice, usually the way it's described in the sutta, happens while you are seated. There's also walking meditation, but this particular meditation, and also the mindfulness of breathing, which I will come to in a second, that is sitting down meditation. That's how it's described in the suttas anyway. Folding his legs crosswise. Sometimes when people read these instructions, and this is exactly the same instruction you find for Anapanasati, they think, I have to sit with my legs, I have to be cross-legged, otherwise I'm not following the instructions properly. So is that the case? Is it the case that you have to be cross-legged to be able to do Anapanasati, to be able to abandon the five hindrances? And I think the answer to that question, I think, is no. It's not actually absolutely required. And I think the reason why it is used in this way is because as a monastic in those days, you didn't have any, often much furniture, you didn't have much choice. In fact, you had grown up as a child, living your whole life, sitting on the floor, and that was what was comfortable for you, sitting on the floor, right, with your legs cross-legged. And there is a couple of passages in the Vinaya, which at least one passage, where it seems quite clear that was the comfortable posture for people in those days. It couldn't be comfortable unless they sat cross-legged. So I think that this is at least one interpretation. This, you know, mind you, it is just an interpretation. It doesn't say this anywhere. But my interpretation is that they used the cross-legged position because it was comfortable. That's how they could sit and forget about the body, right? Let the body aside and then focus on the mind instead. And if that interpretation is correct, then it means that it doesn't matter how you sit. And in fact, I know many people who use chairs and who have very good meditation sitting on chairs. So it doesn't seem to make much difference how you actually, what posture you have for your body. So please keep that in mind. It's important when we read these instructions and suttas, it's important to read them in the right way. So we don't kind of create all kinds of unnecessary obstacles for ourselves. So the important thing, as far as I'm concerned with meditation, and this is the kind of thing Ajahn Brahm would also say, is that you are comfortable. You are at ease. The body can disappear. The body is no longer a problem. Not so comfortable that you kind of indulge, of course. Lying down perhaps might be going too far. But comfortable so the body can disappear. So sitting on a chair is fine. Sitting on a bench, sitting on all these various tools, stools and things that we use. In particular, for modern people who have sat on chairs all their life, it can be quite hard to actually sit cross-legged. It can be quite difficult to. Next one, setting his body erect. And again, you can see why sitting erect is important. When you sit straight, there's a sense of clarity, right? If you kind of crouch over or whatever, or you know slumping, then often that is because of sloth and torpor, or the mind isn't clear or whatever. So setting the body erect is because you want clarity of mind. But again, remember that this has to be done in the right sequence, right? If you set your body erect while you are full of thinking, full of thoughts or whatever, then it can become straining because you're maybe not ready for that, or you're very tired or whatever. Then it doesn't come naturally. So setting the body erect happens at this point when mindfulness already is quite strong. You have been practicing quite well. And that is why sometimes when you practice meditation, it can be good to start off just relaxing, leaning against the wall, sitting against the back of the chair and just relaxing and allowing mindfulness to establish itself. And then you find at the right time, the body will tend to almost want to straighten itself because you get a sense of clarity here. And then that straightening happens, and then it becomes natural, and it becomes easy. There's no sense of strain, no sense of being uncomfortable, because it is unnatural for you. So be wise about this. Don't take these instructions in the wrong way. Always think, what works? How do I get rid of the body in the best possible way? How am I comfortable? How does this work out? It's important. I think it's extremely important that meditation should be an ease, experience of ease, an experience of relaxation, not an experience where you feel discomfort or whatever. Because if you feel too much discomfort, you're going to eventually give up on the meditation practice. But if you enjoy it, it's going to be a powerful tool for good in your life in so many different ways. So make it into something, make it into a power for good rather than into a tool for torture. This is a I think important to keep in mind in meditation practice. So you fold your legs crosswise if you want to, then you set your body erect when you're ready, and then having established mindfulness before one. So again, meditation, this abandoning of the hindrances, and the same is true also for anapanasati, it happens after you have established mindfulness, right? Mindfulness is a requisite for this to work. You cannot do this without mindfulness. So, and this is why this whole training we have been through, what I've been talking about in this in so much detail, because all of this basically is about how to establish mindfulness. If you practice all of these things gradually over time, over the years, over the months, whatever, then slowly, slowly, you will notice in yourself mindfulness becoming stronger over the weeks, over the months, over the years, until one day it is strong enough to be able to do breath meditation, and the breath meditation works. It's powerful. It's easy to be there. You're in the present moment. There is no problem anymore. So having established mindfulness then means these two things. It means that you have to do all these preliminary practices so that mindfulness is generally available to you when it is required. And the second thing you have to do when you come on a retreat, when you want to do meditation, you have to relax and allow things to calm down until that mindfulness arises by itself. So if you have the purity, and then you have the opportunity to be in a nice, peaceful, beautiful environment, like here for example, those are the two factors together that will allow you to have mindfulness. So there is the long-term cause and the short-term cause, which is just kind of chilling out right here and right now. And then meditation becomes possible, and only then is it really possible. So it is a very interesting point here, because very often what people call meditation is not really meditation according to the suttas. Meditation according to the suttas is something very deep. It is only when mindfulness is really established. And a lot of the meditation that we do is basically the purification of the mind to be able to reach a point where we can do real meditation. So we do a bit of metta, we do a bit of just finding ease and finding peace and finding stillness inside of ourselves. We do these things because we know that in the long run they will guide us and lead us to the proper mindfulness. But it's not really the full meditation in the sutta sense of the word, but it's just a kind of a useful practice to bring us in the right way, right direction. And on a retreat like this, we can see that there is a great variety of retreatants. Some people are struggling with defilements and difficulties, and of course that's very natural. That's usually the vast majority on any kind of retreat. And then there are a few who find the meditation going so beautifully, and they're blissing out and having the greatest time of their life. So there's a great variety. You have those who use meditation as a very simple tool just to help them to move forward, and those who actually are there practicing really, really well. So just for you, just so that you see how this is working out. So then, once mindfulness has been established, then the meditation starts, and then you abandon these defilements. Covetousness is just sensual desire, that's all it is. So you purify your mind from that. And ill will and hatred. Again, this is just the five hindrances, right? So you are compassionate for the welfare of all living beings. It's the opposite of ill will. You abandon sloth and torpor. You are percipient of light, it says here. Aloka. Aloka is like clarity. It's not light in the sense of a nimitta. It's just the mind is bright in the sense of clear. That's what it really means. You abandon restlessness and remorse. You are peaceful. And you have gone beyond doubt. You are not perplexed about wholesome states. Doubt in Buddhism is specifically doubt about what is wholesome and what is not wholesome. So it is not understanding, you know, what you should be doing. So once you are a stream enterer, having gone beyond doubt means that you know precisely what the wholesome states of mind are, the wholesome qualities are, and what the unwholesome qualities are. You know what yoniso manasikara is, wise attention, and you know what unwise attention is. So you have complete clarity about the qualities of mind that lead forward on the path and the qualities that do not lead forward. That is one of the qualities of the stream entry. So also the quality here of somebody who is approaching samadhi. You have no doubt anymore about what is going to help you on the path. So that is the abandoning of the hindrances. And as I said, this happens through satipatthana practice. So now let us have a quick look at the very initial formula in the Satipatthana Sutta. I haven't actually included it on this sheet, but I want to have a look at it because it's very relevant for the progress in meditation, and it brings everything quite nicely together. So I'm going to just read it out for you. It's very simple, so it's very easy to do now. It means that the mind is brighter, the mind is clearer, you're not clouded by sloth and torpor. So it doesn't mean nimitta or anything like that, it just means the clarity of the mind. Yeah. Okay, so this is then, because this is about satipatthana practice, I want to just very briefly read out the kind of the summary at the beginning of the satipatthana. It's very, very brief, and I will explain how this fits in with everything else. So this is how it reads in the suttas every time. Here, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu abides contemplating the body as a body, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. He abides contemplating feelings as feelings in the same way, mind as mind, and mind objects as mind objects, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. That is the basic statement about the satipatthanas and how they work. So that gives you quite a bit of information about what satipatthana practice actually is. So let's just analyze this very briefly here. So you abide contemplating body as a body, it says here. I think one possible translation of this is simply that you contemplate the body. This is the idiom of the Pali is such that it's a bit difficult to know exactly what is meant. But sometimes this kind of construction in Pali simply means you are contemplating the body. Or An alternative translation which I like is that you contemplate a body in the body. Remember here that the word body in Pali just means a group of things. It just means a conglomeration of various factors. So any aspect of the body you look at, that can be in itself be called a body. So you're looking at a particular body, a particular aspect of the body in the body itself. And that fits quite well with how this body contemplation is explained in Satipatthana. And it also fits very well with how it is used in Anapanasati. So that is my preferred understanding of this. And you are ardent. Ardent here means you have energy, you have the right kind of effort. In other words, you are practicing, right? You are fully aware. This is sampajana. This is referring back to what I talked about just yesterday here, talking about sampajanya, right? Clear comprehension, clarity about what you're doing. Now here, you can see that clarity that carries over from the previous exercise into the Satipatthana practice. So you keep that clear comprehension in mind. You know the purpose for what you're doing. You have your aim and your suitability clearly in mind. So you can guide yourself as the practice is going. You know that you're going in the right way. You're not getting carried aside. Clear comprehension is there all the time in meditation. So we have built up these qualities before, and now they carry on into the actual meditation practice. That's what's happening here. So that is sampajana. And then you are mindful. So he's ardent, fully aware, and mindful, right? So what that means is that to be able to do satipatthana, you have to be mindful. This is one of the qualities that the person has to have as you start satipatthana practice. And you may know that sometimes satipatthana is translated as foundation of mindfulness into English. And I don't think it's a very good translation. It has been largely abandoned now, but that used to be a translation. Because foundation of mindfulness gives this idea that this is the base upon which mindfulness is going to arise. In other words, it gives the idea that satipatthana will produce mindfulness. But that's not the point. The point is that you already have to have a degree of mindfulness to start satipatthana practice. That is what all the previous exercises are about. And then satipatthana itself, the purpose of that is to produce samadhi and not mindfulness. Of course, it is not as if mindfulness and samadhi can be separated completely. And as you practice satipatthana, yes, your mindfulness will improve, of course. But that is not the main issue. The main issue at stake is that you want to attain samadhi. You have to be mindful already to actually practice satipatthana. So it's an important small point, small but I think important point that needs to be kept in mind. And then, having put away covetousness and grief for the world, now covetousness and grief, we have seen these words before, the words here, actually what they mean, as I mentioned before, is like desire and aversion, like and dislike, that's what it actually means. And this particular one refers back to the sense restraint formula. I don't know if you can remember the sense restraint formula anymore, it's quite a few days ago, and the amount of information I've been giving you is probably so massive that it probably has gone into some kind of, far into the back of your mind. I would be very impressed if you could remember all of these things. But in the sense restraint formula, if you remember back, it says that you restrain the senses so that covetousness and grief does not invade the mind. That was basically what that was about, right? And I said there that the covetousness and grief, the words are abhijja and domanasa, basically meaning desire and aversion, like and dislike. In other words, you either like the object or you don't like it. That's normally our reaction to sensory objects. And now, you see here, having put away desire and aversion, having put away like and dislike, it refers straight back to the sense restraint formula. So again, you can see that all the preliminary steps on the path, they are assumed when you come to satipatthana. They are part of satipatthana. So again, you see the structure of the path, how it becomes important, because all of these things have to be in place for this practice to mature. So you can see all of these things. So having put away The reason you have put it away is because you have been successful in your sense restraint, right? You have succeeded so that those objects are not actually giving rise to desire and aversion. So it ties everything very nicely together. And then, that is then how you contemplate an aspect of the body in the body, how you or just simply contemplate the body as such. That is then how you do that. These are all the required factors. And then the same thing is true for feelings. You contemplate a feeling among feelings. Vedanesu vedananupassi, one feeling among feelings. You contemplate a state of mind among states of mind. And lastly, the last one is dhammas. That is quite a difficult one to translate, and it's not exactly clear how that should be translated correctly, but some people have suggested something like principles. You contemplate principles among principles, and principles here meaning basically conditionality. You understand conditionality. You understand how things arise according to causes. You understand how the defilements arise according to causes, etc. That's the Satipatthana for you. Now, that is all I want to say about Satipatthana. Well, not exactly, that's a bit of a, maybe not quite right. But what I want to do now is to move on to Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing here. And you will find that towards the very end of this little booklet. And to show you why I want to talk about mindfulness of breathing at this point, all I really have to do is to read to you the first paragraph here, and it will become clear to you why mindfulness of breathing is relevant at this particular point. Because when mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it is of great fruit and great benefit. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it fulfills the four establishments of mindfulness. When the four establishments of mindfulness are developed and fulfilled, they fulfill the seven awakening factors. When the seven awakening factors are developed and fulfilled, they fulfill true knowledge and liberation. So there you are. So now you can see here why I'm bringing in Anapanasati at this point. Why? Because Anapanasati fulfills the four foundations of mindfulness. It completes them. If you want to do Satipatthana practice, all you have to do is to practice Anapanasati. You don't have to do anything else. And all four of the Satipatthanas will be fulfilled and completed by practicing simply breath meditation and nothing else. And sometimes that is not so obvious, because when you read the Anapanasati Sutta, it has the breath meditation only under the body contemplation and only under the Kayanupassana. So because it's only under the body contemplation, it looks like it only belongs there. But actually, that's not the case at all. Breath meditation is something you can use all the way to the end of Satipatthana practice. And that is a very useful thing to know. I don't know if some of you may have studied the Satipatthana Sutta before. And what you will notice in the Satipatthana Sutta, the second Satipatthana, the Vedananupassana, for example, and then you have the third one, the Chittanupassana, those two Satipatthanas, it isn't really explained in great detail how you practice those Satipatthanas. All the Satipatthana Sutta does is list a large number of feelings, the Vedananupassana, contemplation of feelings, and it lists a large number of mind states, Chittanupassana, the contemplation of mind states. And then it says you contemplate it internally, externally, and both. And it says you contemplate the arising factors and the cessation factors, etc. But the problem is, exactly how do you do it? And it isn't really mentioned anywhere. And the only place it is mentioned in the suttas, how you're supposed to practice these Satipatthanas, is right here in this particular sutta. And that becomes, for me, that sort of stands out as something very quite important, because this is the only place that is explained. I would say that it is mindfulness of breathing that is the main way for how Satipatthana should be practiced in the suttas. This is the main pathway to actually completing and fulfilling the Satipatthanas. Because this is the only way where it really is explained in any clear detail here. And that has important ramifications, right? It means that suddenly it becomes quite clear how these things should be practiced, whereas otherwise it is open to all kinds of complications and interpretations how this should be done. This clarifies the issues. So then when we practice mindfulness of breathing, we are fulfilling the four Satipatthanas. When we fulfill the four Satipatthanas, we fulfill the seven awakening factors. And by fulfilling that, we fulfill true knowledge and deliverance. In other words, the breath meditation takes you all the way to full awakening, all the way to the end of the path. How wonderful that is. All we have to do is watch the breath. Isn't that great? It makes it so simple. Sometimes the path sounds so complicated. We don't know what to do. So hard. And here, finally, we find the solution. All we have to do is watch the breath all the way through. So, because that is all we need to do, we need to know how this should be developed. And this is what the rest of the Anapanasati Sutta is about, how we should go through this process of developing the mindfulness of breathing here. So now let us have a look at this in detail here. And how, bhikkhus, is mindfulness of breathing developed and cultivated so that it is of great fruit and great benefit? Great fruit and great benefit means, ideally, it means arahantship, right? Maybe not quite, but ideally that's what it means. Here, a bhikkhu, gone to the forest or to the root of a tree or to an empty hut, sits down, having folded his legs crosswise, set his body erect, and established mindfulness in front of him, ever mindful he breathes in, ever mindful he breathes out. So, again, you see, again, the starting here, gone to the forest, to the root of a tree, or an empty hut. This is solitary practice, right? Your mindfulness has been established. Now is the time to seek solitude. So, just as we saw before, with the abandoning of the hindrances. You sit down. Again, it's a sitting meditation. Having folded his legs crosswise, set his body erect. I've already talked about that, so we can skip that now. And having established mindfulness in front of him. So again, this idea of you have to establish mindfulness first. You cannot do mindfulness of breathing without having clear mindfulness. In front of him, this is the word parimukha. This is the word which is so much discussed. What does it mean? Does it mean feeling the breath here or here? Or what exactly is the meaning of this parimukha? And there are a number of people who have investigated this in quite a bit of detail, what parimukha means. And the explanation that I tend to like, and which I see, which seem to fit well with the suttas, is parimukha basically just means in front of you, you know. This is where our attention often is, because our eyes are so powerful, the eyes take so much of the attention. Our attention tends to be roughly here, in front of us. So parimukha has this sense of being present in time and in space. So we are here in time, we're not in the past or the future, and we're also here in space. In other words, we're not thinking about over there or somewhere, we're right here in front of us. This, I think, is essentially the main meaning of parimukha. In front of you, I think, is a fairly good translation here. And of course, if the mindfulness is here in front of us, this is also where the breath normally is, right? This is where the breath can be felt or experienced, roughly in this area. Also going all the way down, but roughly in this particular area. That's where we know the breath. So mindfulness in front of you, it doesn't have to be on the lip or on the tip of the nose or anything like that, as far as I'm concerned. And I think that fits with how the suttas explain this term. So, you have mindfulness in front of you. Ever mindful, he breathes in. Ever mindful, he breathes out. I think that is not the best translation. Mindful is fine, breathes in is fine. Ever is the problem there. The Pali word here is a short little indeclinable particle called eva. And eva in Pali tends to mean only or just. It can have other meanings, but in this sort of context, normally just means only and just. It does not mean ever. Because ever mindful gives the impression that you are mindful all the time at this point. But remember, you're just starting the practice. the mindfulness is still not as strong as it will be later on. When you're watching the breath, you're able to watch the in-breath and out-breath, but you haven't got the mindfulness yet to see the whole breath, for example. We'll see that later on as we go down. So ever mindful is not, in my opinion, a good translation. Better to say something like, just mindful, he breathes in. Just mindful, he breathes out. Or only mindful, simply mindful, he breathes in. Simply mindful, he breathes out. And the point is that simply mindful or just mindful means that you are only aware, you're only an observer, right? This is like when I do the meditation here in the evening, I say you're supposed to be like a passive observer. You are just mindful. You're not involved in the process. You're not trying to control it in any way. You're not using the willpower. You are just mindful. And that, I think, is the importance or the point of this particular phrase. And as you probably remember from this morning, we're talking about a sutta called volition, which talks about how the process of meditation happens. It said there, no volition is required, right? So I take that to mean, not only isn't it required, it shouldn't actually be done, because it gets in the way of the process of samatha. Samatha is a process of calming. Volition is the opposite of calming, it is activity. So by its very nature, it's going to be a problem during meditation practice. So just mindful, he breathes in. Just mindful, he breathes out. That's all you are, mindful, nothing else. So then you have established a preliminary for mindfulness of breathing. And then comes the actual breathing itself, which is divided into 16 steps. And we'll just take them four by four and then explain them as we go through it. So, breathing in long, he understands, I breathe in long. Or breathing out long, he understands, I breathe out long. Breathing in short, he understands, I breathe in short. Or breathing out short, he understands, I breathe out short. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, experiencing the whole body of the breath. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, experiencing the whole body of the breath. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the bodily formation. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the bodily formation. So this is a sequence of four steps, and as always in the Dhamma, it is progressive from the beginning going down, one thing after the other. And it starts off with breathing in long breath, and you understand, I breathe in long. What does understanding mean in this case? I think in this case, understanding basically means awareness. You are aware that this is happening here. But you also have clear comprehension. So if somebody asks you, what kind of breath was it? You know it was long, you know it was short, right? It's part of the awareness, the clarity of what is going on. So it starts off with a long breath. Why is that? Because you are relaxed at this point, right? So you are kind of at ease. And because you are at ease, the breath is relaxed. And when the breath is relaxed, it is often quite long in nature. You are not kind of stressed or anything like that. And then the next step, after having done seeing that the breath is long, the next one, the breath is shorter. And this is what meditators often experience, that the breath actually gets shorter as the meditation progresses. Breath gets a bit shorter during this thing. And I think that is probably what is meant here. That's why the long breath is first, then comes the short breath. Now, you will see there that at this point, you are simply understanding this. You are simply aware. And the next one, you are training. You're training for something. And that, I would interpret to mean that you understand it at this point, because it is natural. When you have mindfulness, this is what you will see. It is natural. It comes by itself. You don't have to actually train or go anywhere or develop the meditation. This is just what happens when you are mindful. And mindfulness is already established, right, through all the previous practices. So this is what you see when you're mindful. But if you want to go further, in other words, if you're going to develop the meditation further, that is why it says training, because you are aiming now to develop the meditation, right? So you are training. So you use this as a kind of roadmap. So the roadmap is there, and you remind yourself that these are the factors I should go through. The breath is long, short, and then you train yourself to experience the whole body of the breath. Sabba kaya patisam vedi. And this is one of those, again, controversial things. What does sabba kaya patisangvedi mean? Patisangvedi is easy enough. It means experience. Sabba kaya literally means whole body. But remember again, the word body is very widely used in the Pali language. It doesn't mean a physical body at all. Often it means that, but often it does not. So kaya has a very broad meaning here. And as I mentioned before, one of the ways that I like to translate the Satipatthana formula is you watch one body in the body, right? And that one body in the body can be the parts of the body, it can be the corpse, you know, the various stages of the composition of the corpse, it can be the elements in the body. These are ways of looking at parts of the body. But one part of the body is the breath. So sabbakaya would then mean feeling, experiencing the whole breath. And in fact, that is what it means in the present context, in my opinion, seems to come out of what is said further down in the same sutta, in this Anapanasati sutta. So I think that is the right interpretation. You are experiencing the whole body of the breath. And what experiencing the whole body would mean is experiencing it from the beginning to the end, right? The breath is like a body. It's like this thing, this conglomeration of various moments. So when you experience the whole body, it means you see it from the beginning to the end. And then out-breath from the beginning to the end, back and forth. You're seeing the whole thing. What is happening here is that your mindfulness is becoming sharper. You see more detail. You're more focused on the breath as a process. And it makes sense that it should mean this. Sometimes people say that it means at this stage you should focus on the whole physical body. But this is called anapanasati, right? We're doing mindfulness of breathing here. It doesn't make any sense to me, at least, why we should now move to contemplating the whole physical body. That's why I think this interpretation is the correct one. Yes. Okay, so then you experience the whole breath, and then the next one is you train thus. You tranquilize the bodily formation. And again, this word formation, which I find is not all that meaningful, the Pali word behind that is sankhara. This is kaya sankhara. And sankhara is now translated by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi as activity. And if you read it like that, tranquilizing the bodily activity, it certainly makes much more sense, right? Because the breath is like an activity in the body, something which is happening in the body. And elsewhere in the suttas, it is very clearly defined that kaya sankhara actually does refer to the breath. So it's quite clear that what is meant here is that you are tranquilizing the breath. So now you are training to tranquilize the breath. But remember that when it says training here, what it means is that you have like a roadmap. So this is what you're aiming at. This is what you should keep in the back of your mind to be able to see that the meditation is progressing in the right way. That is the purpose of this. It is not that you are trying to do anything, that you are trying to force the progress in this way. Training just means that you are looking for this type of development in the meditation practice. That's really all it means. So that is then the first tetra, the first four factors of anapanasati. And already at this point it's becoming very nice. The breath is becoming tranquil, you're feeling really nice and at ease, everything is very soft and pleasant. You're seeing the whole breath, the world is already starting to fade away, right? If you have full focus on the breath, everything else becomes kind of fading into the background. So already it's becoming quite nice. But then we move on to the next four factors. And they read as follows. He trains thus, I shall breathe in experiencing rapture, piti. He trains thus, I shall breathe out experiencing rapture. He trains thus, I shall breathe in experiencing pleasure. He trains thus, I shall breathe out experiencing pleasure, sukha. He trains thus, I shall breathe in experiencing the mental formation. He trains thus, I shall breathe out experiencing the mental formation. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the mental formation. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the mental formation. So, this section, the first section, I should have said, is equivalent to kaya nupassana, the contemplation of body. The next section here is equivalent to vedana nupassana, the contemplation of feeling, in the Satipatthana Sutta. So each of these tetrads corresponds to one of the four Satipatthanas, and we will see that further down there. So here, you are training further. So once the breath starts to tranquilize, what happens at a certain point when that tranquilization reaches a certain point, the piti starts to arise. If you have enough of other merits, if you like, or enough of other factors of the path established, piti starts to arise at this particular point. So you are breathing in, you are watching the sequence, you are making sure that things are going right. Piti, happiness, rapture starts to arise in your mind. So you breathe in and you breathe out, experiencing rapture. And then you deepen that rapture, right? We were talking about before, you remember the sequence, from piti comes pasadi, pasadi comes sukha. So when that piti deepens, when that piti becomes tranquil and peaceful and nice, then the sukha starts to arise. And this is like a deeper form of piti, in a sense. These are just kind of, it's like a mind gradually transforming itself, right? There's no clear boundaries between these things. The boundaries are very kind of fuzzy, but it's like the feelings transforming to become more and more subtle, more and more pure, more and more beautiful. So this is the sukha arising here. And then, when you are experiencing the sukha, these are piti and sukha, two of the often also called the jhana factors, even though it's not a jhana yet, obviously, then the next one is to experience the mental formation. And again, one way of translating this would be mental activity. So this, usually, what is meant in the suttas by mental formation, the citta sankhara. Citta sankhara normally means perception and feeling in the suttas. So this is like whatever you are experiencing in the mind, right? Not just the feeling, but whatever is there in the mind, the mental experience you have at that time. That is what is meant by this, with emphasis, of course, on the sukha and the piti that you're having. So you're experiencing that. So it's like a slight broadening, perhaps, of the previous experience. It is not entirely clear to me how this differentiates from the previous one, but basically it is an experience of the mind at that particular point, the mental formation, the mental activity. And then the next one is to calm all of this down. All the feelings, everything gets calmed down. So calming down the mind, essentially, is what is meant here. I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the mental formation. You're calming down the mind. So, this then is the Vedana Nupassana. You start off with the coarse Vedana, the piti, and you go through the sequence, things getting more and more refined, and towards the end you're tranquilizing it all down. And then, the next stage after that is, now we're getting into the Citta Nupassana, paragraph 20. And this, I'll read through it first of all. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, experiencing the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, experiencing the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, gladdening the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, gladdening the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, stilling the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, stilling the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, liberating the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, liberating the mind. So the first one here is, I shall breathe in and out, experiencing the mind. So what does this mean? Now to understand what that means, you have to look at the sequence here, right? The sequence is, we're going through all these beautiful feelings, things are becoming very peaceful. So what is happening here? The senses are kind of disappearing into the background, the body is disappearing, right? So this is the stage where usually the thing like a beautiful light will start to appear in the mind, right? This is usually that stage. The physical world is disappearing, the last feeling of the breath is starting to disappear. Up until now, the breath has been still kind of the main driving force in the meditation. Here the breath starts to fade away, and the last remnants of the body and the senses fade away. So because the five senses have faded away, what are you left with? You're left with the mind, right? And that often means the nimitta, the beautiful light at this particular stage. So experiencing the mind is what you do when the senses disappear. So that is what is happening here. I think that is a reasonable interpretation of this. So you are experiencing the mind. And then once the nimitta has arisen, then you have to try to work with that nimitta. How can you use that nimitta to make it move you towards real samadhi practice? And part of that is gladdening it, making it more bright, right? Making the experience more happy. And if you read Ajahn Brahm's teachings on how to work with nimittas, this is one of the things that he's very, very skilled at. You know, he teaches this a lot, and you read that in his book, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond. He has a whole chapter on how to work on the nimittas. And he says, you just keep focusing. You keep stilling the mind. You keep focusing on the nimitta, and it brightens all by itself. So again, the training here is not something you do. It's rather something you not do. You just stand back. You keep the focus, you don't do anything, and then the brightening happens by itself. It becomes more glad, more bright. And then, when it becomes more glad and more bright, it becomes also more still, more concentrated. Samadhi happens. You just watch the nimitta, stilling down, becomes even more still than it was before. So this is like a natural process, right? A development. And this is very, very parallel to what we were seeing this morning, the various stages going through the piti, the supasadhi, sukha, and then samadhi. And then last of all, he trains thus, I shall breathe in, liberating the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, liberating the mind. So what does that mean, liberating the mind? Well, this means attaining samadhi. Specifically, it means attaining jhana. That's when this is the kind of the temporary liberation of the mind, right? When the mind is liberated from the five senses, the mind is liberated from all unwholesome states, from the body, it's a liberation because it feels like you have freed yourself from a burden. That's why it is a liberation. It's a temporary liberation. So that is the very last thing you do, the very kind of last process in the mind. The process in the mind is moving towards that liberation. And then when liberation happens, all processes stop, and you become fixed in that jhana state. Yes, sir. It hasn't always disappeared completely, right? The breath can still be in the background a little bit. So the breath is still there, kind of with the experience, with a very, very faint, can still be there. It can, or sometimes it might disappear completely. But this is a stage where the five senses only sees fully in the jhana experience. Prior to that, you can still experience it in the background. So this is the reason, I think, why it is still there, why it is mentioned in this way. But it's obviously not very prominent. You're not really using the breath as such. You're using the nimitta at this stage. That's become the main thing. And the breath is very, very much in the background. Okay. So all of that certainly stops when you get into jhana, and that's why there is no mindfulness of breathing beyond the very last fact of liberating the mind into jhana. Okay, so then we come to the last tetrad. So far we have seen the first three satipatthanas being equivalent to this mindfulness of breathing, and now we come to the dhammanupassana. And as you will see, this has more to do with insight, and that's why I talked about dhammanupassana, perhaps can be translated as contemplation of principles, or perhaps even just contemplation of causality, of certain laws, perhaps contemplation of the laws of nature, perhaps, or something like that. So this is how it reads in the Satipatthana Sutta. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, contemplating impermanence. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, contemplating impermanence. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, contemplating fading away. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, contemplating fading away. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, contemplating cessation. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, contemplating cessation. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, contemplating relinquishment. He trains thus, I shall breathe out contemplating relinquishment. So this, you can see, is really all about vipassana, right? About insight. Here we're moving into the insight territory here. And there's not much insight mentioned before. I mean, you can perhaps argue that there's insight implied here because you are following the sequence, etc. But this is really where insight starts to happen here. So what are we talking about here? What are we contemplating as impermanent? It just says contemplating impermanence. And I think the most likely thing that you are contemplating is the process that you have just been through, right? You've just been through this process where things cease, things come to an end, things are impermanent. So you look back on that process and now you contemplate the impermanence in that process as it happened. So what are the things that have ceased here? Well, things that have ceased are, of course, you know, the defilements have ceased gradually, right? You can now see that the defilements have come to a complete end. So you can see the impermanence of the defilements. You can see the impermanence of the body. The body has come to a complete end. You can see the impermanence of the five senses. They have ended at this point. You can see the impermanence of feeling, the way it changes as you go through this particular process. So all of these things, all of the factors of meditation, of mind and body that you have been going through, you can see the impermanence in all that. And impermanence here means two things. Impermanence means that things are changing. But impermanence also means that things come to a complete end, they stop. That is the deeper meaning of impermanence. And in that sense, impermanence has basically the same meaning as nirodha. Nirodha means cessation in Pali. So impermanence is both this idea of changeability, but also of things ending completely. And that's the deeper meaning of impermanence. So you contemplate impermanence, then you contemplate fading away, right? You see that these things, as you go through the process here, gradually, things become weaker and weaker and weaker. They fade away in the process. This is viraga, the fading away of things. The body fades away, the senses fade away here, the will fades away, everything gradually disappearing here. The viraga has these two meanings, both fading away and dispassion. And here, I think fading away is the appropriate understanding of this term. It is also how it's translated by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi as well. So things are fading away, you're looking back on the process. Cessation, again, you're looking back on the process, seeing things ceasing, right? And you can see how this gives rise to a sense. First of all, you start to understand non-self, right? If something ceases and disappears completely, it cannot be a self. A self, by nature, is something which always must be there. If it isn't there anymore, if it is impermanent, by its very nature, it cannot be a self. You also understand that these things are suffering because you are seeing that something you cannot control. They come and go, they go back and forth. Even more importantly, you understand that they are suffering because now you are experiencing happiness when it has all disappeared, right? Contemplation of cessation. What a relief that all these things have ceased. That's how you feel at this particular point, a great sense of relief. And lastly, contemplation of relinquishment. And relinquishment is when you feel that all of these things are basically impermanent, they are suffering, you understand that they can cease, that they're not actually truly you, then you can relinquish your craving for these things. Relinquishment means abandoning desire and craving. So relinquishment here is the most deep sense of insight, whereby craving, tanha, comes to a stop, because these things are no longer desirable. So that is relinquishment. As you can see here, the step-by-step insight, understanding first impermanence, which is quite shallow, then understanding the fading away, understanding the cessation, and eventually, through doing that again and again, relinquishing it completely by making an end of craving. So this is the insight process based on that whole experience you had before. And again, I want to make the point that in the suttas, how to become an arahant is precisely to contemplate the jhanas in this way, in terms of the three characteristics, in terms of impermanence. So this then is enough to make you an arahant. This is enough to take you to full awakening. Yeah. That is the power of this contemplation. So, the last thing then is bhikkhus. That is how mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, so that it is of great fruit and great benefit. So, it is always already over the hour. There is a little bit more of the Anapanasati Sutta, but that can be done separately because it stands quite easily separately. So we can do that, finish that off tomorrow, and then we can move on to Samma Samadhi after that, to the jhanas themselves. And if we have time, we will take the path, gradual training, all the way to the end, to arahantship. Because it's quite exciting to see the end, right? It's quite exciting to see where all this is heading. That's at least how I tend to think. I think it's quite exciting to see all this stuff. So let's see what happens tomorrow, and let's call it an end for now. Let's pay our respects to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.